The following program is brought to you by Podcast One Sportsnet.
Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at Curology.com/SXM. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation, subscription required. Cancel anytime.
This episode of Steve Austin Show is sponsored in part by DDP Yoga. All right, you guys probably heard I did my very first DDPY workout with Dallas a few weeks ago, and I was blown away with how much I loved it. And I made a commitment to stick with the program for a few months, and I ain't backing down. So I've been doing my regular workouts with the DDP Yoga Now app, and I can definitely feel a difference. And if you don't believe me, just check out this list of folks DDP has helped out with his program. Scott Hall, Goldust, Chris Jericho, Edge, Jake Roberts, AJ Styles, Drew McIntyre, Bobby Fish, Tony Schiavone, and Podcast One's own Chael Sonnen. Dallas is so positive that you'll absolutely love the DDPY program and using the DDPY app. He's doing something he ain't never done before. He's going to give you 7 days free to try it out. That's a week to try the program, explore the app, and own your life, and it's completely free. And listen, when you get on the app, there's a lot to explore because there's a lot of badass content in there that's going to help get your ass on track and help you own your life. DDP Yoga can work for all ages, and that's the bottom line. Whatever your age, your weight, your fitness level is, jump on board. It's a kick-ass cardio workout. It's going to increase your flexibility. It's going to strengthen your core like never before, and it's going to do it with minimal joint impact. And that's something that I really dig. Just for listeners of the Steve Austin Show, you can save 20% off an annual membership for the DDP Yoga Now app, which now features DDPY Rebuild. Just go to ddpyoga.com/Austin to get started. Also, Dallas will be in Raleigh, North Carolina, July 23rd and 24th for the Raleigh SuperCon. He'll be there signing autographs and taking pictures both days. And go ahead and start planning to attend the biggest DDPY workshop ever, happening September 1st at StarCast in Chicago, Illinois. Tickets for the workshop are now on sale. Get more details at ddpyogaworkshops.com.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Steve Austin Show. I am coming to you from the mean streets of Los Angeles, California. As I record the opening of this podcast, it is July 2nd. This podcast drops tomorrow, July 3rd. And tomorrow, my ass is getting up early, loading up the Yukon XL. And my illustrious wife, Kristen, and I, along with Mula and Callie, our silver and black labs, we are headed out to the Silver State to spend the 4th of July in Nevada, out there in the middle of nowhere. Because I'll tell you one thing, L.A. is nothing but headaches, hassles, and horse shit about this time of year. Here they've been blowing fireworks off in Marina Del Rey for about the last 7 days as they get ready to start for the build-up to July 4th. And boy, I tell you what, everybody in this neighborhood of mine, man, they get bottle rockets and they get black cats and just strings of fireworks and they just light them up and just big-ass booms. And our dogs, Mula and Callie, aren't as particularly sensitive as Shona and Hershey used to be. Shona in particular. Man, I tell you what, man, when them firecrackers started going off, that dog didn't know whether to shit or wind her watch. And it just, you know, we'd have to get her Xanaxed up so she could make it through the 4th of July. Or whenever they start throwing the fireworks off, we'd have to sell her ass down. So we just said to hell with it. Let's get out there, go to the BSR 2.0 in Nevada and hang out. And I'm looking forward to getting out there because I'm going to jump on my four-wheeler. Just got me a Kawasaki Terex 2018 model. And I'm going to go out there and take that thing out for a ride and break it in. So I'm looking forward to using the four-wheel drive capabilities of that thing. There's a lot of areas I've been riding around on my Brute Force 750, so I've kind of got everything all scouted out. And I've taken my Kawasaki mules over there, too. So this Terex should be able to really, I don't know, it's going to be a lot of fun. And I got room for three more people. I think I'm going to throw my dogs in there, a cooler, a beer, and just go tear some stuff up. Anyway, hey, man, I think you're going to enjoy today's podcast. This guy's been making the rounds lately on all the podcasts, and his name is Dr. Sean Baker. And if you're asking me, well, who is Sean Baker? Well, if you remember my podcast I did a couple of weeks ago with my friend Chris Bell, as we were talking about Kratom and his documentary, Leaf of Faith, we started talking about the carnivore diet. And Sean Baker is a big proponent of just eating a carnivorous lifestyle. And he's a doctor, he's an athlete, he's a father and a proponent of a carnivorous lifestyle. I'm on his website right now, sean-baker.com. And the dude graduated from University of Texas at Austin. I was born in Austin, Texas. Back in 89, he graduated and went to the medical school at Texas Tech University over there in Lubbock, Texas. Man, he's been in the Air Force. He's been all over the world. He's been a chief of orthopedics at several Air Force bases. He used to play semi-pro rugby. Man, just a stud athlete of a guy. And through all his endeavors and all of his athletic achievements and his search for maximum human performance, man, the dude has turned into just a carnivore and eats nothing but red meat. And I guess his particular favorite is the ribeye. So he's basically eliminated all vegetables from his diet, zero carbs from his diet. Dude just eats ribeyes for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, or whatever you want to call them. That's what this dude is eating, and that's all he eats. He'll eat some burgers here and there, not the bread, the patty, but his go-to is the ribeye. And I tell you what, it's an extreme diet, and in a way, it's kind of shades of a keto diet, with the fat content and protein content of red meat being the ribeye. But I tell you what, man, that's it's a very interesting diet. I gave it a shot for a few days, and I'm still kind of fiddling with it and making some tweaks to it. But I tell you, it's very interesting. But he swears by it. He swears up and down by it. It's helped out his body composition. It's helped him in his in his quest for world records on the Concept 2 rower. People that have followed his program have talked about getting stronger, have talked about getting leaner, and talked about getting bigger. So, I don't know, listen to the podcast, and he was on my podcast. He's been on many. If there's any podcast out there, I mean, he's been on them. So, wait to listen to this one, listen to a few other ones. You know, maybe it's something you want to give a try. Like I said, man, I've made some tweaks and adjustments to the carnivore diet. I'm a guy that actually likes vegetables, and you know, I've listened to and watched so many testimonials on YouTube, you know, after I talked to Sean, and people that were saying, hey, man, all their inflammation markers went down once they started this diet, or all of their symptoms of inflammation or other illnesses that they suffered went down when they dropped out a lot of the starchy carbohydrates, etc., and adhered to this strict carnivore diet. So seeing that I like vegetables, cruciferous vegetables, leafy green vegetables, not really too much starchy stuff. It doesn't really set real well with me. We'll see how long I continue this journey, but I'm doing my version of it, and we'll see how it all plays out. But interesting conversation. The dude is a wealth of information. Extremely smart. He's been doing this for almost 2 years continuously, and just, you know, he's on top of the world with it. He absolutely loves it. Very limited to me. Man, I cooked up 3 big-ass ribeyes the other day, and I still got 2 left. And these are some big, badass beef ribeyes that I went over to Bob's Market and went to during the weekend and fought traffic just to get some of the best steaks I could. And man, I still got 2 of those sumbitches left to eat. And man, I tell you what, I think I'm going to wear my teeth down to a nub eating all these god dang steaks. But nonetheless, check out the podcast, and then send me a damn question to questions@steveaustinshow.com if you have any comments, or let me know how you do on this diet if you decide to partake in it. Again, I'm a few days in on it, but I've modified it a little bit, and I'm throwing in some chicken thighs, and I'm still eating my spinach and green beans, the butter, lettuce, my salads with tomatoes that my wife makes for me. You know, I enjoy eating shit like that, so I haven't just completely gone carnivore hardcore. But Sean Baker has, and my conversation with him is coming right up. And we're going to get to Sean Baker and the carnivore diet after we go through a little bit of his background, some of his training, some of his accomplishments. But before we get to Dr. Sean Baker, they say soccer is the football of the rest of the world. Only soccer's championship lasts an entire month. That's right. Get into B-Dubs where they've got match day select domestic beer specials and a special select mashup to go along with their already loaded roster of 21 sauces and seasonings. That's enough combinations for a full month's worth of delicious cheering. Catch all the soccer action at Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports. Offers vary by location.
There's never a dull week in the world of professional wrestling, so to keep up on all of it, be sure to subscribe to the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast here at Podcast One. I produce two new shows each week. Every Thursday on our flagship show, I'm joined by a co-host from the wrestling journalism field to talk about the hot topics in WWE and elsewhere. Every Friday, I'm joined by a guest who has worked in the wrestling business, including ex-WWE creative team members like Kevin Eck talking about Drew McIntyre.
Drew was a young guy, and did it go to his head, and did he walk around like he was the chosen one? He did, and I was frank with him, and I said, Drew, just so you know, this is how they view you.
And Podcast One's own Christian Harloff, talking about his days working for WWE, and Vince McMahon specifically.
As far as the perception of him, I mean, he's the king. He walks in, and it's just, you can feel it. I mean, if the force was real, you would feel the force powering into the room when he enters.
Just search Wade Keller on Apple Podcasts or on the Podcast One app or anywhere else you listen to podcasts.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
Well, I'm rolling sound. I got Dr. Sean Baker sitting in front of me all jacked up. Big ass stick of wood, 6'5", what?
Yeah, about 245 right now,
245,
Steve.
What's your body fat?
I don't know, man. Whatever it is, what it is. I'd say probably I'm sitting around 12%, something like that would be my guess. I don't measure it. I don't really care. Just whatever it is. As long as I feel good and function good, that's my main goal.
Man, I started hearing about you when I was talking to my buddy Chris Bell. And then I heard a little bit of you on a Rogan podcast. And then I heard you'd done a Rob Wolf podcast. I mean, you're making rounds. And I didn't listen to everything, but I've been trying to do some research, but I don't know a whole lot about you. I know you're an orthopedic surgeon. You've been an athlete all your life. Big-ass dude, 700-pound deadlift. When was that deadlift done?
Well, so I hit my best deadlift when I was in 2000, when I was about 33. I hit a 772. I did that as a drug-free lifter back then. I hit 711 when I turned 40. And now I'm 51, so I'm trying to get back 700 again. I pulled 500 for 10 easy reps without a belt. You know, I'm pretty close to that right now, so it's not too bad for.
Dude, and that 772 and that 700 when you was 40, those yeah. Straight up clean.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those are
yeah.
Monster numbers.
Yeah, I was.
What were you weighing then?
Back then I was probably about 280. Yeah, I was a bigger guy, but I was fatter. You know, I wasn't as lean as I am now. So it's kind of, I could never bench press because I got these long monkey arms.
That's a bench press.
I mean, I was like a 400-pound bench presser, which is all I could do, but I could deadlift, you know, pretty decent. I could squat. Not bad, you know, but.
No, but you brought up a good point. I didn't notice how long your damn arms were.
Yeah, they're long.
Like I said, that does help on the deadlift.
It does. Yeah.
But 7'7" is a good number for anybody.
Yeah. Yeah. I was pretty pleased to hit that. I was pissed I didn't get to get 800 because it was kind of funny because I did that when I was in medical school. And I did that 772 as my second attempt and I went for 783 and I just almost had about a little tired. It was almost midnight. We were one of these powerlifting meets where it starts at 9 o'clock in the morning, a little small meet. It was a group called NASA, a guy named, I can't remember the dude's name, but it was just a one platform, like 100 lifters. So you wait all day. You wait. And by the time you're deadlifting, it's like 10, 11 o'clock at night. You're worn out. I pulled 772, tried 783, couldn't get it. And then I started, you know, the hard part of medical school where you're just working like 100 hours a week, 120 hours a week going into residency. So I probably could have got 800 if I didn't have to get, do all that stuff.
Hey, man, when you walked up on the sidewalk, I flagged you down. You didn't see me stand underneath that tree. You said, hey, man, you're from Edna, Texas, aren't you? I said, are you from Texas as well?
Yeah, so I moved there when I was in high school. I got a funny story about Edna if you want to hear that.
Oh, yeah, I got plenty of time for a story.
So, yeah, but I went to high school in a town called Lake Jackson, which is, you know, southeast Texas, just a little north of where Edna is, you know, because you know, the Surfside Beach and all that stuff. So I grew up, went to high school there and went to college at University of Texas. But so, and no offense to Edna, but the one of the worst days I ever had in my life.
No offense to Edna.
No, I'm sure it's a nice town, but I went there one time and I had one of the worst days of my life, and I'll tell you about it too. So I'm in Austin, Texas, University of Texas, you know, college kid, knucklehead. And like any good story, you know, there's something called beer that makes you do things you're not supposed to do, you know. Some dumb things happen when you're drinking too much beer. So we're in Austin, Texas, drinking some beer, and my buddy, he's got a buddy who lives in Edna named Chuck, and I can't remember Chuck's last name. He's a rice farmer. I guess they have to
do a lot of rice farmers.
Yeah, so he's a rice farmer out in Edna, and he goes, "Hey, let's go see Chuck." And we're in Austin, Texas, young guys. I'm like, okay, there's much beautiful girls in Austin, Texas, and we're going to go see some rice farmer down in Edna.
There's two in Edna.
So we go down there, and we're drinking and, you know, doing stupid stuff we're not supposed to be doing. We get to Edna probably, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning. We're in his barn hanging out, drinking beer. And I was this kid. I didn't really like, and it's kind of weird because I'm this carnivore now, but I didn't really like vegetables. I didn't like Mexican food. I had all the peppers and all the crap in there I never liked. So I get in there. And one of the farmhands comes in. I think he was an illegal guy that was hanging out. And he comes in there with these tamales. And I'd never eaten tamales at that point. And he offered them to me. And I said, no, thanks. And apparently it pissed him off because his mother had made them. So, we're kind of not fully half inebriated. And then he pulls a pistol out at it and points at me and said, "You eat these tamales." I ate the tamales were actually pretty good. It was his mother's recipe. But so we get down to Edna, and I'm in there getting a pistol pulled out on me. And then we have the bright idea, something like 3 o'clock in the morning, let's go on down to Mexico. So you can go down to Matamoros and go down there and do some stupid stuff. So we get down to Matamoros, and the sun is coming up. And we get in there, and we left our car on the borders, thankfully. We walked across, and we kind of hitched a ride with some local guys. And we got in the back of this guy's car, three or four of us. And as soon as we got in, the police came up and say, "You guys have too many people in the car. You got to go to jail." So they stick us in jail. You know, I guess whatever's across the border from Matamoros. We sit in jail for 6 hours. No one knows where we are. We're sitting there, you know, sobering up, going, "Oh, crap." And the jail cell was literally one little room out in the middle of the street. It was like a zoo exhibit. And they had a hole in the floor to piss in. And they're, you know, they sit there and we have no idea what's going on. And finally they go up to us and say, "Pay the fine." "Well, what's the fine?" They just keep yelling at us, "Pay the fine." So we emptied all, we had like 15 bucks between all four of us, gave us some money. And then we were literally on the way back trying to get gas. We're digging up pennies out of the floorboard, you know. So that was my Edna, Texas story. So I'm sure there's some nice stuff in Edna, though.
It's a one-horse town. They got a Sonic. They got a McDonald's. They got three donut shops for a town of 5,000 people. On the one, they got three donut shops. But, hey, man, so Mexican food is my favorite food in the world. So you don't dig it so much.
Well, I used to like the fajitas. I mean, I used to like the fajitas. I'd get fajitas with a little rice, little beans, and a tortilla. I love that. I didn't like the tomatoes and the onions and stuff for some reason, whatever reason. I was a weird kid. But yeah, man, I mean, it's got some good spice and stuff like that. But, growing up, I just never, because we moved down from, maybe because I moved down from Indiana. I was a basketball player, moved down to Texas, you know, and I should have been a football player, but I was a basketball guy. So kind of, just maybe didn't go real well.
When did you decide you was going to be an orthopedic surgeon, and what made you choose the University of Texas of Austin? Because I was born in Austin, Texas.
No, you're born in Austin. Oh, nice.
Yeah, born in Austin, Texas. My mom and dad got divorced, and we went down to Victoria and Edna.
Yeah, Austin's a nice place. So
it is, but it's so crowded.
Well, it is now.
You have a loop around.
It is now.
I mean, to try to keep it weird, and it's so jacked up with traffic. It's heaven over there.
That's what I said.
It's too much traffic.
When I was there in the 80s, you know, late 80s, going to college, it was still like 350,000. Now it's like over a million. And they just haven't built up the infrastructure, so now it's a disaster with traffic. But
I agree.
Yeah, so I thought about being a doctor when I was about 16. That's when I was thinking I was studying for the MCAT. You know, this is something I wasn't going to take till I was a junior in college, studying for that stuff. I knew orthopedics was, you know, it had a lot to do with sports, because I've always had it. You know, yep. I've always been involved, you know, interested in the musculoskeletal system, strength training. I've been a meathead longer than I've been in any. Well, you know, I've been doing that since I've been 13 years old lifting, but. You know, but then, you know, I just, you know, as I kind of went in there, I got a biology degree from Texas, University of Texas, and then I went down to UTMB for my, it's kind of funny, I started medical school at UTMB, I got a year into
What's
it.
What's UTMB?
University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston.
Okay.
It's a big hospital, and you may be familiar with that, but, so I went there for a year, And then I left medical school to go play rugby. I went down to New Zealand to play rugby. I got recruited to go play. I started playing rugby my first year of medical school. And then I ended up being just pretty good because I was a pretty good athlete. I could jump. I could run real fast. And they were looking for people in a team in New Zealand, which New Zealand has got – that's where rugby is. I mean, that's like the capital of the world. So I got recruited to go play down there. And I did that for, two seasons. And then I came back. And then I was like, well, I don't want to go back to medical school yet because I still want to play rugby. And the best place to do that in the U.S. at that time was in the military. So I joined the military. I went into the Air Force. My day job was to launch nuclear bombs. I was a nuclear bombs weapons launch officer. I was, we were up in the, you see that there was a movie called War Games where they had the guys that were down in the hole and we had like 10 nuclear warheads attached to us and we would do that. And then I would play rugby for the military. So I did that until I was about 30. And then I remember I was laying on a rugby field playing this team from Russia and they were just kicking me in the head. I had blood coming to my ears. I was 30 years old. I was tired of getting beat up. And I said, all right, hell with it. I'm going to go back to medical school. And so then the Air Force was kind enough to send me back to medical school. I ended up finishing up at Texas Tech. And then I went back down to University of Texas Galveston and did my orthopedic surgery for residency training for 5 years of that. And so then I did that. Went in the military, got sent to Afghanistan where we took care of all this, crazy, crazy trauma stuff, which I thought I talked about a little bit on the Rogan show. But that was an interesting experience. And then I did that, for several more years. And that's kind of where I'm at now.
So you played all that rugby, you got kicked in the head, decided to go back and get your medical degree. Did you play high school football or anything like that?
I didn't. I played.
Why not?
I didn't move to Texas till the end of my junior year, the middle of my junior year. And I was coming from Indiana, which is bottom night country. And that was basketball. And so I got to Texas. And I was still pretty thin at that time. I mean, I was about 185, 190 pounds, same height as I am now. So it took me, it took me a good, 10 more years of lifting to really put on the muscle. So, I mean, but, I kind of regret I never did it. It would have been fun. I mean, I played rugby. I was fast. I mean, I was, 4'6", 4'7", guy, when I was at my peak.
Pretty good speed for a guy your size.
Yeah, I mean, I was about 240, which I'm at right now about, I don't know if I don't think I'm quite that fast anymore, but I'm still decent, but I could jump well. I was pretty strong, but, like any sport, you got athletes, but you got to get technically good at the sport. Right. There's years and years of that stuff that goes into that. That's like, people when they talk about, you could just do this whatever sport, but when you talk to people that have been at the top, it doesn't matter what their sport is. They put in so much time to get there and you just can't walk in. It doesn't matter who you are. You can't walk in there and just do it, at least for most sports.
Right. Now we're here to talk about the carnivore diet, but man, I'm really interested with your training. Because, heard some of the deadlift numbers. I've been on your Instagram account watching you do, stuff on the Concept 2 rower, world record holder in that. But when did you start with the powerlifting stuff?
Yeah, so I started powerlifting, basically, I'd say the first time this is kind of funny, the first time I ever deadlifted, this was a bet. So I used to work at UPS in Angleton, Texas. I don't know if you know where Angleton
was. I know exactly where all those
towns are. I loaded trucks. I was an unloader while I was I started out at a junior college before I went to UT, but I was unloading trucks. So we'd get there at 4 o'clock in the morning. We'd go in there and we'd unload all the, load the trucks for the UPS drivers. And my boss was going to college with me and I had a bet with him, something about, I didn't have to do something to work. We were at the gym and there was a little gym. I can't remember what it was called, but, I went in there and on a bet, I said, I bet I can deadlift this. And it was 455 and I'd never deadlifted before. And that was my first time deadlifting. I pulled 455 from the floor as an 18, 19 year old kid, which is just, so I had some natural ability at that.
Right.
I'd been training, lifting and doing that stuff, but I'd never tried deadlifting before. So I kind of got into that. And then when I went to the University of Texas, there's a gal named Jan Todd and her husband, Terry Todd.
Yes.
Yeah, Jan and Terry Todd. So Jan was a former strongest woman in the world. Terry was, he was like U.S. Olympic lifting champion back in the day.
And extremely knowledgeable.
And he's been a curator at Strength Sports forever. I mean, he has all Mark Henry and all these top guys. He's been with that. He's got a whole museum on strength. So I trained with Terry and Jan Todd in college, started doing the powerlifting, then kind of shifted over to rugby, did that. And then I kind of went back to powerlifting. I remember the first time I pulled 700, I think it was 26. And I was able to pull 700 for like 20 more years, or something like that. I maintained it for close to 20 years. And so I kind of did that. Then I went into throwing. No, I did strongman for a little while. I did a couple years of strongman. I really liked the training. It was fun. But I couldn't overhead press worth a damn relative to what you need to do for strongman. So I was good at truck pulls, good at deadlifts, good at lifting Atlas stones. Did that stuff in my late 30s, and then I got into throwing. And I know you met a guy named Matt Vincent, I remember.
Yes.
And Matt was a world champion in he won it 1 year, 1 or 2 years. I know Matt won.
Yeah, 2 years.
So I won it as a master. So they have a mat, you know, over 40. Yeah. So I won the world championships in Highland Games when I was about 43 or 44. I started throwing when I was 41 and just fell in love with it because it's so fun. But so, and then when I got done throwing, when I got tired of being 280 pounds and not feeling good and changing diet, and then I went into this rowing stuff and trying to work on being leaner. So my training has been kind of an evolution and a conglomeration of all those sports together, you know, cause throwing, you know, throwers are some strong son of a bitches. I mean, yeah. If you've been around some Olympic shot putters, those guys can put up some numbers and they're strong and they're fast and they're powerful. And, so, you know, I kind of took some of that stuff. I took the powerlifting, the basic stuff. I do the conditioning, the high level conditioning. And so my training right now is a little bit of everything because I think, particularly as we get older, you know, you gotta maintain muscle. It's very important to maintain lean muscle mass. It's very predictive for longevity. You know, if you want to be on this earth for a long time and not be a little decrepit shell that can't do anything, you gotta maintain that lean muscle mass. And then you gotta maintain a decent amount of VO2 max. You got to maintain your fitness. And so, you know, that's kind of where my focus is now.
You seem to be a proponent for high intensity interval training as far as your cardio, just what I've seen on Instagram. Yeah. But going back to when you were training with the Todds, what was your powerlifting routine? I don't mean specifically, but how many days a week were you working on big lifts, or how many days were you training versus what you are now all these years later and with all the knowledge that you've accumulated in your endeavors?
Yeah, I think, and that's a long time ago, but I'm pretty sure, I mean, I know we had some programs we followed. I know that at that time they were playing with step-ups. And that was something that was, you know, becoming the unilateral training I think they were looking at back in the late 80s. But I think I was doing about 4 days a week powerlifting. You know, that was basically the focus, you know, and I think that works pretty well for most people. Nowadays, you know, it just depends. You know, it depends where I'm at. Like right now, the only thing I'm doing, like this month, I'm rowing and doing push-ups, and that's it.
This month.
Now, because I want to break that world record 1,000 meters. When I'm rowing, you look at the numbers that I put up on Instagram. Most people don't know what the hell they mean, but I can tell you, it hurts. It's a lot of pain. You got to recover from that. But after I do that, then I'm going to go back and switch over to deadlift, see if I can't pull a 50 plus US record on the deadlift. And so I'll do that probably in the fall. So I'd like to break the world record on the rower this summer and then maybe break a US record deadlift, for the 50 plus group in the fall. So that's my current athletic sort of thing. So it'll change up.
Did you ever have any interest in bodybuilding?
No, I mean, I just don't have the genetics for it. I mean, I got monkey long arms. I'd have to weigh 300 plus pounds to do it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, I don't have the, you know, there's guys that are blessed with symmetry. My muscle bellies aren't made the right way. So it's just not in the cards. So I think I respect the guys that do that. It's a lot of hard work, a lot of dedication, you know, just the, you know, the, you know, it's not just the training, but it's the dieting. It's a mental discipline that goes into that. But you know, like I said, it's like I'm not going to be a horse jockey. You know, yeah. I
mean, you would be one tired ass horse.
Yeah, it would be. You know, I was on a horse in Mexico one time. It was the end of the day. Went down there, and I think it was Cabo San Lucas, and we were on there. And you know, it was the end of the day, and they gave me this horse. And I think that horse was pissed off. Get my big ass on there. You know, it was, and you could tell when he got close to home, he wanted to run because he was like, get this big gorilla off my back. And yeah, but I mean, there's people that, you know, you figure out, you know, this is like the Chinese, they do that really well. Chinese and Russians, they put their kids in there and they say, you ain't gonna be a basketball player. You know, your parents were 5'6", don't even think about basketball. And so you kind of tailor, your sports for what you can do. So bodybuilding wasn't going to be. And then rowing is pretty good for me because, you know, if you look at the Olympic rowers, they're all about 6'4" to about 6'7". And they're usually around 220 to 245. So I'm right in that frame for rowing. And then, you know, having a nice set of lungs helps. And so I've got those things. You know, maybe if I was started rowing when I was a college kid, I might have been a decent rower, you know. But right now, like I said, it's a skill. And to learn the water skill without falling in the water would take years. So right now I can do the indoor stuff, which the Olympic rowers, you know, like when I put like my concept two time for the 500 meters, I pulled a 114. Most Olympic rowers, like even the gold medalists, can't quite do that. You know, and granted, they're training for a little bit longer distance, 2,000 meters, but still, it's a level of effort that I'm still able to put out at, you know, 50 plus years of age, which is, I think, pretty interesting.
Man, I've really never stepped on a concept or any type of rower for that matter, maybe a time or two in my life. But I was just like, man, I'll get on. I got an air assault bike behind me, as you can see. When did you get on that machine? Because you're an old school guy just like me. When did you get on a rower and say, hey, I like this and I'm pretty damn good at it? And it hurts like hell when I'm doing it the way I need to do it.
Yeah, first of all, I mean, that air assault bike is a damn good piece of machinery. I think, you know, because I've got something similar. It's called an Air 9. It's called an Air 9 X. It's like a beefed up version of an Air 9. Octane Fitness makes that thing. Okay. But I got it in my garage. And that thing, more than the rower for me, if you want to beat yourself up metabolically and do those sprints, you know, you go 20 seconds all out. I mean, all out. Not like, you know, screwing around, but you're going all out. And then you recover for, you know, whatever it takes, 2 minutes typically to really hit that all out. That's going to give you a big, you know, big amount of benefit. But the rower, I remember I think I did it like years ago. I don't even remember, just screwing around in the gym and like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with it. And then I hopped on it about 4 or 5 years ago. I saw it in the gym and I said, I'm going to do a 500 meter because CrossFit has made that very popular. And so I said, well, I'm going to go in there and see if I can pull 500 meters just for the hell of it. And I jumped on there and I think I did it like 132 or something, which is not a bad time. And I was like, I can do better. And I did it the next day. I came back and I pulled a 125. And I was like, that might be good. So I started looking up records. And then I was like, wait a minute. The record for this is only, you know, a few seconds more. So I said, you know, F it. I'm going to try. So I started training for it. And actually, there's a guy named Zeno Muller who lives down in Newport Beach who is an Olympic gold medalist. And so I trained with him for a while and just trying to working on technique and making sure I'm efficient. And, you know, I just started doing that. And then I just started, you know, like anything you get obsessed with, like anything you're going to break a world record, you got to be obsessed about. And so I got obsessed about it. You know, I studied how to do it. I just worked. You almost meld into the machine because you just kind of, you know exactly what you're doing and you kind of tinker with every little part. And so that's kind of how I did that. And I just, it's kind of funny because, you know, when you're doing that, and I'm sure you feel like you feel the most alive in my view, when your adrenaline's going, when your heart rate's pumping, that's when you really feel like you're alive and you miss that. You know, I'm sure when you were wrestling and you had that going, you just felt like, you know, now I'm alive. And then, you know, when you don't get that stuff, like I miss the contact of rugby. I mean, I really miss that. I miss being able to run around and to smash into dudes. And, you know, you wish you could do that in society with people to piss you off. You may go in there, you know, elbow to the chops and say, all right, we'll settle this. You know, we can't do that these days. But
any type of cardio endeavor for you, when you're going to work out, it is not to burn fat. It's not steady state. You're not doing it just to doing it. You're doing it to reach that goal.
Yeah,
I mean, and just take the world record away. Yeah. If you were just doing it to maintain a level of fitness, you're going hardcore and you're going high intensity.
Yeah, I like to call it a chainsaw interval. You know, and the reason I say that, you remember Freddie from Chainsaw Massacre? You know, was it Fred? Who was the guy that Chainsaw Massacre?
I can't remember.
Yeah, but anyway.
Freddie was from
Friday the 13th.
Friday the 13th or Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, one of those guys. But anyway, you know, Freddie Krueger, that's right. But so I imagine, like, if I'm sitting on an air assault bike, I imagine there's a dude with a chainsaw chasing me, and I go like my life depends on it, you know, and I say, I'm going to do that for 15, 20, because you can only sprint, you know, technically you can only sprint about 12 to 15 seconds before you switch over from your creatine phosphate system to anaerobic glycolytic system, so you're not as efficient. That's why the world record sprints are, you know, the top out speed, like Usain Bolt topping out at 28 miles an hour or something like that when he ran his 109.58. But so I only go for about 12, 15 seconds typically as a hard sprint. Maybe I'll drag it out to 20 because then you start to feel a little bit. And I go as hard as I can and I see what my number is. You know, I look at, if I'm looking at calories, say it's, you know, like on the Aerodynex, I'll hit in 15 seconds, I'll hit about 22 calories. And, you know, because I'm going hard, you know, and then I'll go again. And if I don't hit 21 or 22, I didn't rest long enough and I didn't go hard enough. And so I want to make sure I keep doing that. And I'll do that until that drops off. And so it may be 6 reps, it may be 7 reps. And then I'm like, okay, now I'm not productive anymore. It's just the way I approach that is that I want to hit that intensity and, you know, I'll get the benefit from that. You'll get plenty. I mean, if you do that, I mean, you'll find it, you know, you're getting a lot of effect out of that.
Okay. So when did you start really getting involved with that rower?
Probably 3 years ago was when I really started.
So you hadn't kicked in the carnivore diet yet. So just with respect to the high intensity type cardio you were doing on that rowing machine or an aerosol type bike, Did you notice a change in your body composition when you really kicked in that intense cardio? Because just because a lot of my friends are bodybuilders at Gold's Gyms, and they'll steady state, all this stuff. But you, I'm sitting here right in front of you. You're a lean guy, world class in the rowing stuff. So how did that change your body before we get into the nutrition aspect of it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, this is, you know, here's the deal, Steve. So when I was 44, you know, I'm sitting about 285, you know, and I was strong. I was still running sprints, lifting heavy, doing all this. I never stopped that stuff. I was still doing, you know, I always felt I like running sprints. I go out of the track, run 40 meter sprints, 50 meter sprints, do 20 sets of that. And I'd always done that. But, you know, until I changed my diet, I kept that 280. And then at one point, it coincided. I went through a divorce, and the same thing. You're like, okay, I'm tired of being a fat slob type stuff. So then I went on a pretty big caloric reduction type thing. I was working out three times a day. I get up in the morning, jump rope, hit a couple thousand jump ropes, go to the office, see patients, come home at lunch, cause I live right next to the hospital, do a weight workout, you know, come home from work, play with my kids, put my kids to sleep, jump rope another couple thousand times, go to bed, do it day in, day in, day out. And then I dropped my calories in half, basically. And so I dropped 50 pounds in, you know, 3 months. I mean, it wasn't hard. Got down to like 230. But then I was like, I just don't feel very good. I can't do this stuff forever. And that's when I started changing all the kind of diet stuff. But, you know, so that got me leaner. And so I've been 51 now, 51 and a half. So about 7 years I've been sitting here at a relatively lean condition. And, you know, diet has changed. Now is more about performance, strength, and health for me, because I'm happy where I'm at, you know, from a, you know, body composition standpoint. So I'm really worried about how do I feel, how to perform.
So did you read about the carnivore diet and said, hey, I'm going to try this? Because you kind of went through what? You were kind of just eating basically everything. Then you kind of paleo, or weren't a big vegetable fan.
Yeah.
But how did you end up being on the carnivore
diet? Well, I mean, you know, like,
just
like,
say, hey, the only thing I'm going to eat is a damn steak.
Well, it was an evolution. I mean, I went through, low fat, high fiber, you know, near vegetarian, a little bit of fish, a little bit of lean chicken, kind of like a bodybuilder diet might be, you know, a lot of, you know, greens and lean meats. And I did that, and that works. I mean, it certainly does. But for me, it was just, and I think if you talk to any bodybuilder, when they get down to contest shape, they don't feel very good. And they're like, I can't wait to go refeed. You know, I can't wait to hit that pizza and do all that stuff, because it's hard to maintain that for a long period of time. You can do it for a short period of time. But so, you know, I was excluding that. I looked at, you know, Marxist and stuff and the primal paleo type stuff and raw wool stuff. And I did that stuff and I felt pretty good. I was including more stuff, you know, and, you know, you're making all the recipes, you're looking at all the almond flour stuff and all this stuff. And then I went into, then I started kept reading. I read Gary Taub's stuff and started reading about that, and then looking at the science behind this stuff and trying to figure this stuff out. And then I was applying, then I went into, I eventually ended up in a keto diet, like I know you've done. And I felt pretty good. And I saw some interesting health things. I started seeing some improvements in things like joint pain, which I'd had a little bit, because I was a little bit beat up from doing, as you might imagine, all that years of training. And then I started seeing it with patients. You know, so we were putting patients on ketogenic diets, and they're like, hey, my knee pain, it didn't hurt. You're good. We'll cancel your surgery. That didn't go well with the hospital eventually. But so for me, so then I just started reading about, like, you know, Vince Guaranda, steak and eggs, you know, back in the day, you know, and you know, how he was doing this stuff. And I thought, well, that makes sense, you know. And I didn't buy into the meat is bad, and I don't. And I think it's ridiculous that we think it's that. The evidence that points to that is so weak. We can certainly talk about that. But so I started trying that, you know, and Vince's routine was like 4 or 5 days steak and eggs, and then you have a carb refeeder or whatever for one day. And I was doing that, and I felt really good when I was eating steak and eggs, and I'd do the carb refeeds, and I had tried the cyclic ketogenic diet and the targeted ketogenic. I tried all this stuff. I've done it all. With that, I said, I feel pretty good, and I really like the steak. It tastes good, and yeah, you take steak and eggs. And I was eating sometimes a dozen eggs a day. I mean, I was crushing that stuff. And then I felt really good. And then I started reading, you know, there's people that have been doing this carnivore stuff for 20 years. You know, I started reading about these people that have been doing it. And I look at them, and there's a guy named Joe Anderson out of Florida and his wife, Charlene. They've been doing it for 20 years. She had real bad Lyme disease and was obese and sick. And they said they went on, you know, basically a red meat diet, and they just got healthy. And you look at them now, I mean, they literally look 20 years younger than what they are. If you look at their pictures.
Yeah, I saw the pictures. They don't even work out.
He says he does a little bit of calisthenics every once in a while, and she doesn't do anything. She just kind of chases her kids around. So they look healthy. And then I discovered this community of people that were doing it. And I started reading about it, you know, and skeptically. I mean, I think it makes sense to be skeptical. I think you should always be skeptical about this stuff. But these folks were just talking about joint pain going away, which I'd seen with keto. So I thought that's credible. I mean, it's kind of the same sort of physiology going on, but even more so. And then they were talking about things like autoimmune diseases going away, and particularly digestive things, which I know that you have mentioned that, but things like Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis and then psoriasis and all these and mental health. We saw a lot of the mental health. So I just kept seeing this over and over and over again. So I said, well, I'm going to try it. You know, I'm going to try it for a week. And I did it for a week and I survived. I didn't die. I didn't get scurvy. My colon didn't fall out. So then I did it for 2 weeks. And then I remember it was December of 2016. I said, I'm going to do it for a month. And I, you know, I'd been on Twitter at that point and people were talking and we were goofing around and saying, what am I going to die of in this month? You know, am I going to get scurvy? And everybody's, and we did that. And so I did it and just as just an experiment. And I just felt really good. And then I started, and then I said, well, okay, that's fun. The month was over. Let me go back to eating my normal keto type stuff. And I did that. I did that for a day and I just didn't feel as good. And I was like, well, you know, I don't really miss eating salads. I didn't really miss eating spinach and I don't feel as good eating them. Why do I need to eat them? So I said, well, I'm going to go back to carnivore for a while. And then by about 2 months in, what really was interesting to me from an athletic standpoint, because well, first of all, I'd had tendonitis in my quadriceps. My right quadriceps bothered me for like about 12 years, and it never went away. And as an orthopedic guy, you know how to treat tendonitis. I'd done all the tricks. I know. And I was just accepting that I'm just getting older. That's part of life.
Right.
So 2 months into carnivore diet, I said, "Wait a minute, my tendonitis is gone." And I thought, "Well, maybe it's just a day or two." And then it's still gone. So almost 2 years later, it's still gone. Or a year and a half later, it's still gone. So I thought that was just really interesting. And I started seeing other health things going, you know, getting better. Skin things, sleep was getting really good. But my performance in the gym, which was really interesting because, you know, as a rower, I was pretty, you know, I was training pretty hard. I was a big, strong guy. I was pulling, you know, from on the concept to 116.5. I'd already set the U.S. record for the age group. But when I went carnivore, I dropped another 2 seconds, which was about 8% increases in wattage, which is a lot of power increase, you know, when you calculate the numbers. And the same thing with my strength. I remember with the deadlift when I was in my 46, I said, well, my goal is to pull 405 for 20, you know, without a belt. And I got to where I was hitting 15, 16, but I'd always just die at 15, 16 reps. I couldn't get past 16 reps.
That's a lot of damn reps, 4 or 5.
Well, but then I went on carnivore, and the first time I, you know, 2 months in, the first time I did, I pulled 18. Like, wow, I'm stronger.
Right.
Then the next week, I pulled 20. And I was like, I've literally been trying to do this for 5 years, and I couldn't do it. And then I changed my diet. You know, I was eating, you know, again, I can postulate why that is, and I think there's some good roots, good interesting things going on with that as to why you get stronger. But I clearly got stronger. I clearly got better power output on the rowing machine, and my recovery is better. And so those were the things that were really fascinating to me. Then when you go back and you look at historical accounts of people like the Mongolians, the Inuit, the beef eaters out of England, you know, they were given extra rations because they knew it made them more powerful fighters. And it's just a strength food. You know, guys like, you know, I had Charles Poliquin call me the other day. I don't know if you have Charles Poliquin strength.
No, I haven't had much show, but I read a lot of his articles.
But he called me up and he said, "Hey dude, I love what you're doing. And let me tell you, when I was eating 5 to 6 pounds of beef a day, the best I ever felt, the strongest I've ever been in my life." And he's like, you know,
Charles told you that.
Was it?
Charles did.
Yeah, he called me up and did it because Chris Bell, you know, I know he was here and talked about this stuff, but he called me up and said, yeah, man, that there's something to that. And so that was interesting. And I think there clearly is. And, you know, it's not isolated to me, but now, because since I've been doing this and have kind of, you know, been very vocal proponent about it, lots and lots of people are doing this right now. We've got some really high level athletes that are starting this now with very good results, which I think is very interesting. There's a guy named Owen Franks, who is a member of the New Zealand All Blacks. He's a professional rugby player, one of the top guys in the world, started a carnivore diet in December after he heard me on Rogan. And he said, "I'm getting stronger, I'm getting heavier, and I'm getting leaner."
Come on.
Seriously. Yeah. And they just got done whooping on France's ass. I mean, in rugby is it's a lot of running, stop, start, you know, glycolytic activity, a lot of strength stuff. So he's doing that. We had him on, we've got our own little podcast, not as big as this one, but, I had Owen on our podcast talking about this stuff and he's doing well with that. I've got a lot of wrestlers. So there's some guys that are doing it in the retina. I don't know if there's any like WWE stuff, but you know, there's different levels. I'm sure right. You know that. And there's some guys from different levels of wrestling showing me, hey, I'm on a carnivore diet. I'm performing better. I'm getting leaner. Their body composition is getting better. Baseball players, MMA guys, you know, all endurance athletes.
All right, let's take a quick pause for the calls and give big ups to TrueCar. Here's some useful car tips you might not be aware of. Putting your floor mat under your tires in the winter can help you get your car out of the snow. Removing excess weight from your car will improve gas mileage. Keeping a Dixie cup of water in your car to put your cigarettes in is a better option than throwing them out the window. Are you ready for one more tip you might not know about? TrueCar also helps people get used cars. That's right. TrueCar ain't just for buying new cars. With their certified dealer network and nationwide inventory of nearly 1 million used cars, you will enjoy real pricing on actual inventory and a simpler buying experience, whether you buy new or used. And with TrueCar, users can see what others paid, so they know if they're getting a good deal before buying. And they're also more likely to enjoy a faster buying experience by connecting with TrueCar certified dealers. When you are ready to buy a new or used car, check out TrueCar and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. You're also going to need car insurance for that new vehicle. Go to GEICO.com, and in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. That's right. Save hundreds of dollars on car insurance at GEICO.com. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding thing you do today. All right, podcast fans, do not miss John Taffer. No Excuses, a brand new show from Podcast One. Shut it down and listen to John, the award-winning hospitality legend from Bar Rescue, as he brings his straight talk and unapologetic approach to daily topics and current events. You don't want to miss his latest interview with Adam Carolla. Subscribe and download John Taffer, No Excuses, every Tuesday exclusively on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and the Podcast One app. Also, remember to rate and review. We always appreciate your feedback. Listen up. If you're one of the millions of Americans who suffers from muscle cramps in your legs and feet, relief is finally in sight. TheraWorks Relief is a topical foam that's clinically proven to relieve muscle cramps fast, and with daily use, TheraWorks Relief can even prevent muscle cramps before they start. Finally, you'll be able to get a good night's sleep and do all those activities you love and not worry about muscle cramps. TheraWorks Relief is a life-changing product, and best of all, you don't even need a prescription. It only takes minutes to apply, absorbs quickly, and it really works. It's time you made it yours as well. Get TheraWorks Relief today at select CVS, Rite Aid, and Walgreens pharmacies, or at TheraWorksRelief.com. That's TheraWorksRelief.com.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
But let's talk about the diet itself.
All right, sure.
Because you wake up. Mm-hmm. Also, just with respect to your total calories, just on based on what I saw on your Instagram account, you're in between 3,500 and 4,000.
Yeah, I'd say. You know, I mean, on most days, you know, it's about 4 pounds, you know, which is more than most people eat on this, you know, because, you know, like I said, we're big guys. You're going to eat more. Most people are eating about 2 pounds a day, which, you know, 2,500 calories if it's fatty enough. I don't worry about counting macros, you know, because one of the things is if I eat enough one day, then I'm not, you know, if I eat too much one day, the next day I'm not going to be as hungry and vice versa. If I don't eat enough the next time, I'm going to be hungrier. And when I train really hard, my appetite goes up and I just eat more, and it just works pretty well. And it keeps me, you know, where I'm at right now. Now, if I wanted to get, you know, bodybuilding contest prep shape, I'd have to do something different, but I don't have a desire to do that. I just want to sit around here at whatever level of body fat I am and perform well.
Okay, well, take me through a day's worth of eating.
So, I mean, right before I came up here, you know, I went on a road this morning, blasted out a little workout, did a bunch of push-ups. I ate two big old fat ribeyes, probably about 2.5 pounds or bone in.
All together?
Yeah. Just
in one sitting?
Oh, easy. Yeah, easy. I mean, that's just, you know, well, I'll talk about this in a second. But then probably this evening when I get home, probably around, and that was probably, I think I ate those, well, I worked out earlier. So I probably about 9:30, I ate those, you know, before I came up here. And then probably when I get home around 5:36, I'll eat either one, maybe two more, depending. So that'll be about probably 4 pounds. If I'm extra hungry, I might eat a little more. So that's it. That's my day.
But then on the road, sometimes you'll roll through a Wendy's and get a bunch of hamburger patties.
Yeah. I mean, if it's on the road, because, you know, it gets expensive eating steaks out all the time, particularly if you're going to go, hey, give me 3 pounds of steak. They're going to look at you funny. Unless you go to like a Brazilian, you know, those Brazilian
eat
things. I went to one of those in Denver and I put down 6 pounds, you know, one setting, which is pretty good. I mean, that was a decent meal there, but I didn't eat. But then here's the thing. I didn't want to eat again for about 36 hours because I was like a damn snake that swallowed a damn goat. You know, I was like, ah! But I think that's how it works. And you know, there's interesting societies like the Mongolians were reported to have eaten 10 pounds in one sitting. They would sit down, they'd crush 10 pounds of meat, and they might not eat for a couple of days. And that's just how they did it. There's a gal, I'm trying to get her on my podcast, named Molly Schuyler, who is a woman's competitive eater, and she has eaten 22 pounds of steak in one sitting. And she weighs 125.
Holy cow.
Can you imagine that? 22 pounds of steak?
No, I can't.
I mean, that's that much damn steak. Yeah, but I mean, this is we've got, you know, like there's historical counts, like the guys on the Lewis and Clark expedition, supposedly they were eating about 9 pounds of meat a day just to fuel their activity. So when somebody looks at you like, wow, 3 pounds, it's no big deal. I mean, once you do it for a while, I mean, if I don't eat anything under 2 pounds is like not eat, it's like a snack now for me. Literally, I mean, it's just like, okay, where's the food? You know, it's kind of interesting. And the same thing with, and a lot of people that do this, like chicken, you know, chicken, you know, this is interesting. In the United States, since about 1977, when we peaked in beef consumption, has dropped about 40%. So the overall consumption of red meat in the United States has gone down about 40% since about 1977.
Really?
Yeah, it has. But what's happened is chicken has gone up. So we've traded for beef for chicken. I think chicken is an inferior food, quite honestly. But it's kind of interesting because as we've seen beef production go down, beef consumption go down, we've seen obesity and diabetes and all the other crap go up. And so the people are trying to blame it on red meat. I'm like, wait a minute, this doesn't really go well. I mean, we can talk all day about what's not wrong about red meat because there's all kinds of misconceptions out there. You know, the whole thing about, I don't know if you're into the cholesterol, you know, because a lot of people, you know, they worry about your cholesterol. Mm-hmm. There's so much new data out there that shows that cholesterol as an independent marker is not a very good marker of heart disease. You know, you have to look at it in context. You know, there's a guy named Dave Feldman who does a lot of work about cholesterol. He just demonstrated that if your triglycerides are low and your HDL is above a certain number, it really doesn't matter what your LDL cholesterol is with regard to heart disease risk. And so, you've got to put all this stuff into context. It's like for me, you know, when I check some labs, I got criticized for a couple of things, but my testosterone was low one day. So everybody's like, oh man, you're low testosterone. I'm like, yeah, whatever, man. I'm pulling, you know, 500 pound deadlifts for reps, you know, and it's like you have to remember your testosterone level goes up and down all the time.
What was the level at?
It was like 230. It was low, right? So people are like, oh my God, you got testosterone of a grandmother. But here's
someone told me on Twitter, ask him about his testosterone level.
Yeah.
They said it was low.
Yeah,
so that wasn't a concern to you at all.
Well, I understand what clinical context means. I mean, I'm sitting there. I mean, I wake up with a damn heart on every fucking day,
right.
You know, ready to go. I mean, there's no problem in that department. I'm lean, I'm muscular, I'm stronger than for a 51-year-old guy. I'm in the, you know, top percentage of that. So I'm not worried about clinical testosterone function. You know, I checked it a week later. It was 100 points higher. But here's the thing. When you work out really, really hard, sometimes your testosterone drops. And I just got to train with Mark Bell and Chris Bell at Super Training. So I tested that. The other thing is we know that our testosterone receptor sensitivity can go up. And so if your receptor sensitivity goes up, you may need a little less. And I think that's true for any hormone.
Well, so the ribeye is your steak of choice. I mean, do you not like the filet just because the fat content is not as high?
Well, I mean, you know.
Or the flavor is greater?
I like the taste of ribeye. I like filets, too. I mean, it's just, you know, filets tend to be more expensive, as you probably know. You know, you can get a porterhouse and you just cut the filet off of that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's because there's, for people who don't know, porterhouses are New York strip and filet. The T-bones, technically, it's only about, if it's more than 2 inches, then they can call that a porterhouse, the filet side. If it's less, then that's just straight up T-bone. But, you know, again, this goes back to, kind of human evolution. You know, when we were hunting big old fatty animals, mammoths, you know, any animal over a certain size is going to be about 50, 60% fat. And I think that's just a natural human desire. Once you're at sort of normal body weight, I think if you're obese and metabolically deranged, things are different. You might do better, a little leaner stuff for some people if they can tolerate that. But I think for me, I just need the fat for energy. I mean, I really do.
Right.
I mean, I got to power the machine, and protein, Protein is okay. It's not a real efficient source of that stuff.
So you said that the chicken was inferior to red meat.
I think.
Why is the chicken in, from a nutrition standpoint?
Well, I think, chicken is lacking a lot of nutrients to the degree that red meat has. I mean,
because the bodybuilders are living on chicken breast.
Well, I mean, they're living on lean protein. You know, that's why they're eating chicken. It's just a lean protein. But if you look at the actual nutrition in chicken, it's lower in heme iron, it's lower in carnosine, it's lower in carnitine, it's lower in some of the B vitamins, it's higher in the omega-6s. Chickens do not have as good of a capacity to filter out the crap that they're fed like cows do. Cows have a better capacity to deal with what they're fed. The other thing about just chicken, again, people that do this for a long time, they'll consider chicken like salad. I mean, they'll eat it. You know, I can sit there and eat a bunch of chicken. I'm like, okay, when's the food going to get here? I mean, it really is. Once you do it for a while, I'll tell you, I mean, I cannot tell you how many people that if they've done it a month, they find it like, man, this is really not that appealing, man. Give me a damn steak. And so, you think about, Steve, think about if you and I were, back in prehistoric times, and there's these big old fat juicy animals running around. All we got is spears, and there's some birds. Well, what are we going to kill? I mean, we're going to go for the big fat
juicy ones.
We're going to get the big fat juicy because they're easy to kill. They don't run away. I mean, I don't know if you've been to Africa. I've been out of Africa down in the Serengeti. And when you see these elephants, when you drive up to them, they don't run away. They turn in unison, like 10 of them. They'll turn at you and go, what you looking at, motherfucker? I mean, they just look at you because they're so used to because no predator is going to get them because they're so damn big. But humans figured it out. They were smart enough, even though they were smaller, particularly when they got projectile technology. But it's clear that they figured out how to ambush them, sneak up on them, stab them real quick, and then they just waited for them to bleed out. And that's how we got them. And so trying to kill a damn bird with a spear, how hard that would be. So I think, again, from an evolutionary standpoint, we weren't likely eating a lot of birds. Now, it's interesting that humans eventually, and what happened was, as those big animals went away, we had to figure out how to kill all these other animals. We developed all these technology, the bow and arrow, because we needed it. Before, all we needed was a damn spear, and we got all the food we want, so we didn't have the impetus to invent this stuff. But once all those elephants and mammoths went away, we're like, oh crap, our food's gone. Now we got to think. Now we got to use our brain. And that's it's kind of interesting. One of the reasons that we kind of evolved more into Homo sapiens, because it became more complex to get the required nutrition we needed. So we had to, think more. And so that's pretty interesting. But chicken is not, I mean, it's fine. You can eat it, but it's just not, if you go ahead and do this diet, Steve, you're going to find, you start with it, eat all you want. But I think if you find about, 30 days, 6 weeks in, you're going to like, oh man, chicken, man, give me a damn steak.
What about salmon? Not a big fan?
No, I mean, it's fine. I ate salmon. The last time I had salmon was about a year ago. I eat more than anything is shrimp. Because, my kids and the rest of my family, they don't – my girlfriend's doing full carnivore this month. She was about 90%. She used to be a vegetarian when I met her. She was from France.
My wife is a vegetarian. She's the first vegetarian I ever met in my life. And I took her down to South Texas, and she was in trouble because nobody's a vegetarian in South Texas. Yeah. So it was a learning process. When you started dropping this carnivore stuff on her, did she look at you with her eyes like this and say, what are you doing?
Well, she saw me progressing, because she was a vegetarian. And we've been going out for about a little over five years now. And she was having all kinds of digestive stuff. And I said, well, let's just start changing. She kind of went through the same process and went keto and started feeling a little better. But she watched me transition. She's used to it now. She just thinks, okay, you're eating your steaks. It's definitely, mentally, it's a different thing to do. There are, so many people now that have done this now. And it's just, I cannot tell you how many, I started collecting stories at meatheals.com because I want to show people that there's some, not that everybody needs to be doing this, but for people that have medical problems like autoimmune disease or diabetes or high blood pressure, my dad, he's 74. He went on a carnivore diet last year and he had blood pressure problems his whole life. I mean, he was 20 years, he's on pills, could never get his blood pressure down into a normal range. Carnivore diet, within 2 weeks, he's like, wait a minute, my blood pressure's normal.
I saw him doing his wind sprints on a beach now.
Yeah, did you see that? Yeah. I thought he doesn't do, my dad's not an athlete. He's never, well, he played basketball up into his 40s, but he'd never been a workout guy, never been a lifting weights guy, never did that. And it was kind of funny. I saw him, about 6 months after he'd been done. He looked like he got 10 years younger than me, but so he's in there telling me about living on, he's living out in Jekyll Island in Georgia. And I said, hey, Dad, there's a beach. Why don't you go run some sprints? He goes, yeah, I'll go try it. So he videoed it. That's the first time I think he ran a sprint in years. And he looked not too bad for a 75-year-old guy out there running nine sprints.
Is he still on a diet?
Yeah, he's still doing that. I think he eats a little. I think he's like 99%. Maybe he has something here and there. I've seen him eat some fruit and stuff like that. I'm like, whatever, Dad. But, you know, he had colon cancer. And I put him on the diet. You know, I know there's concern about red meat and colon cancer, but put him on the diet. He got a follow-up 6 months later after he been on the diet. Colonoscopy, completely normal. The guy said, there's nothing going on here. And that's, you know, to me, very interesting. I think that's good. But, yeah, the oldest person I've seen on the diet right now that I know of that's consistently doing is 87. There's an 87-year-old dude is, you know, he's like, the best I've felt in 20 years, you know. But he started when he was 83, so he's been doing it for about 4 years. So we got all kinds of people doing it. Kids with, you know, parents giving with kids with autism doing it. They said their autism's getting better. Autoimmune diseases. I mean, it's just a really interesting thing. There's a group out of Hungary called the Paleo Medicina Group who's formally looking at this diet, and they've got about 4,000 people they've done, you know, with clinical results. Universally very good. And they've done things like Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, irritable bowel syndrome, some of those other things are really responding well to that diet. So it's interesting.
So you're doing this, I mean, because of the way it makes you feel, performance oriented, basically. Yep. So let's say you beat this world record. Okay, you got it.
Then I got to get a deadlift record.
Deadlift
second.
But will you continue to eat like this?
I would say I'll probably, like everybody else that does this, I will probably continue to eat a hell of a lot of red meat because I am convinced it's a health food. I have no concern about it being dangerous. I think that, you know, whether I, you know, maybe I'll say I'll have some raspberries. You know, I'll be up in Seattle next week. And if there's some raspberries there next year, maybe I'll, or not raspberries, blackberries, I'll pick them. I might have some. And if I feel fine, I'm fine with that. And this is the thing. The nice thing about this is you can critically assess what food does to you. You know, once you're at a baseline, because you've only got one variable. If you're just eating meat every day, you're like, okay, this is how I feel. I added in, you know, whatever, broccoli, and I got all gassy, my guts hurt. Maybe or maybe not you need to eat the broccoli. I think this is the interesting thing because a lot of people, when they go on a carnivore diet, their microbiome is going to change. You know, there's a lot of information about the microbiome, right? It responds to what we eat. It responds to how much exercise, how much sleep we get, what the temperature is, what the weather is. There's a lot of things that impact that stuff. So when you're on this diet of one kind of food, your microbiome shifts. So when you add those other food backs in there, it causes digestive upset. And I think that's probably okay. You just have to wait that out so you can kind of reintroduce those foods. But if you start seeing, okay, wait a minute, now my tendonitis in my elbow came back, then that might be a different issue. You know, like I said, there's a lot of people that when I was seeing patients before, they would tell me, hey, if I eat something, my knee would hurt. And I'd look at them like, you're kind of crazy. You're kind of nutty. But now I understand that, you know, now it's very common to see people with, you know, my joints hurt when I eat whatever food.
What do you think would happen if you started introducing starchy carbohydrates back in your diet and just say, you know, in the vein of building strength, you know, you started and
yeah, I mean, I could do like
300 or 400 grams of carbs a day.
Well, 300 or 400 grams of carb, you know, right? Initially my blood sugar would be really unstable because I'm just not used to processing glucose, you know, at least from carbohydrate in my diet. So that would be a problem initially. You know, what would it do to my insulin resistance or my insulin sensitivity? I don't know for sure. You know, I know for one thing, and this is the one thing that a lot of people have a hard time sort of believing or understanding is that a high fiber diet would probably be not very pleasant for my gastrointestinal tract. And I know there's a lot of people that feel so much better when they leave the fiber out. But I think, you know, from my perspective, if I were to introduce carbohydrates in that I would suspect wouldn't bother me, they would be simple starches. They might be some low sugar fruits and stuff like that. I think those things would probably be tolerated the best by me. I think the things that I would do less good with are, you know, really high fiber things like vegetables, which I don't even like anyway. So I'm not, I have no desire to go eat it. If I'm going to cheat, it's going to be a piece of chocolate cake, not a plate of broccoli. There's just no desire for that. So, you know, again, I did the, you know, when I was doing keto, I was doing a cyclic ketogenic diet, which is kind of similar, you know, where you have these high carb days. Mm-hmm. I just didn't feel as good after the high carb days. I just felt, I mean, I remember at first I was excited because I get to eat all this stuff. And then it was just like it became a chore because, you know, you're following these things where I got to eat 800 grams of carbohydrate today. And you're just like chewing, you know, trying to get through all right. that stuff. And so, maybe I'll test it down the road and see. I mean, I did a couple of days where I added some rice to check my blood sugar, doing a blood glucose test just to mess with that. And I just didn't feel awful. It wasn't miserable. I didn't feel like awful, but I just didn't feel as good. I mean, you know, honestly, like even I'll do dairy every once in a while. I'll eat a bowl of yogurt, you know, and I feel like I'm at 98%. You know, then when I just go straight up red meat, I'm like, now I feel 100%. So that's a difference.
What does someone on a carnivore diet eat for dessert?
Bacon. No, I mean,
you're a lean dude. You're in good shape. You basically don't have any glycogen in your system, right?
No, you do. You do have glycogen. I mean, you know, here's the deal.
Not as much as if you were eating 300 or 400 grams.
Well, I mean, you could probably tell, but again, you got to remember my blood glucose runs a little higher to compensate. And I think that's what's happening there. Cause I can do glycolytic activity. I will tell you, Steve, if you get on an air assault bike or the Concept 2 rower, and go all out for 3 minutes or 2 minutes, that is a glycogen requiring activity, mm-hmm. or glucose requiring activity. And I've gone out there and run rugby, you know, touch rugby playing around for 2 hours, ran for 2 hours, no problem at all. You know, Jeff Volek and some of these other researchers have studied some of the low carb stuff, and they see that guys, at least in a ketogenic diet, they tend to not utilize as much glycogen when they're performing. And then what they saw is the next day their glycogen levels were pretty much equal to the other folks. And so I don't know that it's a glycogen. You never really deplete your glycogen out to zero. You can't really do that. You always maintain stuff. It's just not possible to suck every molecule of glycogen out of your body. So I suspect I have, the glycogen I need. I mean, again, it's ultimately performance. You know, it's like either you can do it or you can't. And however you get there is however you get there. But one of the things we know with carbohydrate, you swell up when you get on carbs, right? You know, and mm-hmm. one of the things that goes on with carbs is, again, you have that big insulin spike. Insulin causes your kidneys to reabsorb sodium and water. And so you just get more water in you. That's why when people go on a ketogenic diet, right. they lose all that water initially. So, but when your muscles are full with water, right, you're more pumped and you actually perform a little better, you know, because you're a little stronger. But this is one thing this is a way you can kind of go around that. And this is what I often do is you can just take some electrolyte. I just drink salt water before I work out. I take about a teaspoon and a half of salt water, chug it down there. I increase my water, my body water, my intravascular water, because I usually chase it with a couple glasses of water. And now I have more water, you know, intravascular and within my, you know, within my muscles. And then I get a bigger pump. You know, like when everybody likes to go to the gym, they like to pump with their muscles, you know. And so that's how you can kind of hack that, you know, as far as training goes.
If I was going to give this a try, how would I go about it?
Well, I mean, I would, you might want to try a variety to start with. I think just from a mental aspect, don't undereat. This is the thing. I know you like to calculate. I know that's something.
Yeah.
But what I would say, you know, there's a transition period where you just gotta, how do I mentally cope? And I think that is eat like it's your job. You know, just like, you know, get ribeyes, get New York, go to whatever you like. You're from Texas, you know how to cook a damn steak. Cook the steaks, you like them. You know, you might have to play with a little bit more electrolyte in the initial standpoint. You know, if you want to do dairy, you know, I would limit it. I wouldn't go crazy on the dairy, maybe a little bit of cheese on your burger or something like that. If you want to taper off fiber, because that sometimes helps, you know, some people, when they go directly, because here's what happens. Meat does not sit there and rot in your colon. That's a complete myth, right? We know that from patients that have had ileostomies where their colon's removed. We can look and see what goes through the small intestine. When you eat meat, completely digested, only a little bit of liquid comes in there. So everything that's getting to your colon, you're just getting a little liquid. So a lot of people they'll not make much. They'll be like, I'm not going to the bathroom very much. And some people will go 3, 4, 5 days without a bowel movement. They'll freak out. I'm like, you ain't got nothing to get rid of, dude. Chill out, you know. But some people have diarrhea because their colon is not used to dealing with as much liquid. And so what happens is your colon takes time to readjust to that. So some people will find it just gradually tapering out the fiber. Maybe normal, most people, like 20 grams a day, maybe go to 10 and then 5 and then cut that out. So you could do it that way just so you get used to that. But cook more than you think you need, because what will happen is, you'll eat, you think, oh, I'm going to eat a pound of steak, a big old 16-ounce ribeye. And then 2 hours later, you're hungry again. So have some more around so you can just put that in your mouth. And you'll figure it out. You'll figure it out that, for you, you'll easily be able to put down 2 pounds of steak in one sitting, no big deal. And then eat whenever you're hungry. Because once you start thinking about, oh, man, because, if your wife's a vegetarian, you're going to have all this. You got all kinds mm-hmm. of food now, all kinds of temptation. I'm the same thing. My there's other food in my house, but I don't even think about that now. But if I'm hungry, have something that you can eat readily available. Have an extra steak cut up. Have some bacon fried up. And I don't think you should live on bacon. I mean, a lot of people get excited about it, but bacon is not the ideal thing. Bacon is not great. It's okay. It's a nice flavorful snack, but you're going to do better with just either ground beef or whole cuts of meat. I think that's going to be more nutritious for you, but have that stuff available. And so anytime you think about, man, I'd really like that potato chip, or I'd really like shove a piece of meat in your mouth. And you do that for 2, 3, 4 weeks in a row. And then all of a sudden you'd be like, I don't need that stuff. And then you'll get to a point where, you just like, then when it's dinner time or whatever, you're like, damn, give me a steak. And then you'll start salivating. You'll be like the dogs. You're like, I don't know if you're, if your dog, when you get ready to feed them, there's a pile of drool on the ground because they're doing that stuff. But that's how I would do it. If you want to include seafood and salmon and shrimp and chicken and spice it like you like it for now, eventually I got to where I just throw salt on there, a little bit of salt on my steaks, and I'm good to go. And I think that's probably the most effective way to do this. You're probably going to find you're going to drink more water, because it takes a little more water to process the protein that you're going to be ingesting. I don't know how much protein you're eating now, but if you're eating ribeye, you're going to be at about 30-35% protein. And I think that's a pretty good area to be. New York strip's going to be up a little bit higher. If you are tired, if you're lacking energy, if your performance is like, just eat more. It might be a little more fat, might be a little more volume total. That's going to get you through. Because the biggest negatives I see for people is like, I don't have any energy. It's like keto flu when you go through that.
Right.
I just don't have the energy. A lot of times because you're like 3 pounds of steak, that's a lot, right? There are women, like we talk about Molly Scott, they're little women, 5 foot one, 120, 110 pounds, 3-4 pounds in one sitting. No big deal. So you have to kind of get out of your mind that I'm eating too much. Just eat to your appetite. Because more likely what will happen is if you sit down and crush 3 pounds of steak, I'm just going to eat this stuff. You're going to be full for 16 hours. You're not going to eat again. So you don't have to intermittent fast. You don't have to set the stopwatch. Your body will just tell you. And then once you get down to, I'm only eating one damn thing, well, then you're like, well, why do I have an appetite? Well, it's your body saying, hey, dummy, give me some fuel, give me some structure. And so that's why most people will end up about 2 meals a day. That's what I typically do. Sometimes 1 meal a day. If I eat four pounds in one sitting, that's it. That's going to be my meal for the day. So, and it becomes real easy. I mean, the cooking is easy. You got a knife, you got a fork, you got a plate. And then if you got, I don't know if you got a grill or whatever, or reverse sear. I don't know if you know how to reverse sear steaks. Mm-hmm. Heat it up in the oven, get it to about medium rare, however you like it. Throw it in the pan, sear it up, maybe a little butter. But enjoy it. What I tell people to do is count how many steaks you enjoyed. Don't count macros, don't count calories. Just count how you feel and just assess how you feel. But I wouldn't worry about the scale. I wouldn't worry about body composition for the first month. I would just say, well, let's get through this transition period. And then when you get to, where you're comfortable, then you can say, well, maybe I'll eat a little more leaner this week. There's some bodybuilders that are doing this, and I'll talk about them. They have ways they cycle fat and protein to, just like we manipulate other macros to get really, if that's your goal. But like I said, if your goal is to be a swimsuit model right now, then, but if your goal is, I just want to feel good, be pretty lean and function well, then I think it pretty much takes care of itself.
Do you think the carnivore diet is better than a ketogenic diet as far as strength?
For strength, for sure. Absolutely. Yeah, because I think ketogenic diet, they restrict too much protein. I think that's one of the big knocks. The classic ketogenic diet, everybody's scared to death about protein. They're like, oh my God, protein's going to kick me out of ketosis. I don't measure ketones. I don't care about ketones. I care about performance, how I feel, and what my body composition is. And so I think that, again, protein is muscle. I mean, in a nutshell, I mean, that's, you know, it doesn't matter what bodybuilder you are. You got to get sufficient protein in there. I think one of the problems with the ketogenic diet for a lot of people when they implement it is they under protein themselves. And that's why you had more success by modifying it.
Right.
And again, this is, you know, what you're doing is basically what nature was doing from a macro standpoint. You know, eat big fatty mammoths, you're going to get 30%, 35% protein, the rest is going to be fat. You're not at that 80%, 90% ketogenic ratio, but you're more in line with what humans need to eat. Now, the question is, do I need to get there with fake foods and nutrition bars, or do I just need to eat what was on the planet for 2 million years, which is meat? So, yeah, but I think strength-wise, you'll see the more red meat you eat, the stronger, particularly red meat, I won't guarantee it, but most people so many people are saying, I'm hitting PRs in gym, my deadlift number's gone up, my pull-ups went up, and your recovery goes up. So you'll find that you can, you know, one of the keys to successful training performance-wise is you got to train with your right amount of intensity, and the more frequently you can do that, assuming you're recovered, the better your performance is going to be. And so if your recovery is better and you got better fuel, you're going to ultimately do better strength-wise.
I might give it a shot.
Well, let me know, Steve. I'll be happy to. I'm not far from you. You got my number, and I'll be happy to answer any questions and stuff.
Well, before we close this thing down, tell people about your podcast, where they can find that, and also where you're at on Twitter and Instagram.
Yeah, so the podcast is it's called the Human Performance Outliers Podcast. It's me and Zach Bitter. We got some great people on there talking about all kinds of stuff. But
what kind of stuff you talk about?
Well, we've got a double amputee coming on. He's run 31 marathons in a row. We got like guys like Tim Noakes out of South Africa, some of the diet stuff. We had an anthropologist on. We've got some people that do the carnivore stuff, different diet stuff. We're trying to get Molly Skye, the competitive eater, on.
Where's
there.
Where's your race out of?
I think she's out of Nebraska. Okay. I'm not sure. She's got an interesting story. She was just a mom, like single mom, and was trying to pay bills for her kids, you know, struggling. She saw an eating contest. They paid some money, and she won it and did well. Said, hell, I can make money doing this. And now she's like dominating. I mean, not just women, but men dominating the world on eating, you know, 22 pounds of steak in one sitting. So you eat like 501 wings in one go. So, I've been pestering her, trying to get her to come. She said she'd come on, but she hasn't given me a date yet. So if you're listening, Molly, come on our podcast. But yeah, Human Performance Outliers Podcast. Instagram, I'm Sean, SHAWN, Baker, 1967. And then on Twitter, it's SBakerMD. And those are where I'm most active right now. And then check out meatheals.com. There is countless stories of people improving health conditions by going on a carnivorous diet. And we categorize them by things like arthritis and mental health and autoimmune diseases and digestive issues and weight loss and diabetes and high blood pressure. They're all categorized. So if you have a particular topic you're looking at, you can click on that and find 20 people that have gone through the same thing and talk about how carnivory.
Good talking to you.
Man, it was a pleasure, Steve.
I'm going to give it a shot.
Awesome.
Hey everyone, it's Scott Braun and Kelly Nash from MLB Network here with our new show, Baseball and Chill, exclusively on Podcast One Sportsnet.
Kick back with us each week as we cover all of the action on and off the diamond with player interviews and in-depth storyline analysis of what's happening in Major League Baseball.
Relax with us every Tuesday on Baseball and Chill right here on Podcast One. Download and subscribe to new episodes exclusively on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and the Podcast One app. Also, rate us. Leave us feedback. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, we would.
All right, everybody, give me the go-home cue. It's time to wrap up this podcast and ride off in the sunset. Before I do that, I want to thank Dr. Sean Baker for coming by the house today and talking to me about the carnivore diet. If you decide to employ this diet strategy on yourself, please mark it on your calendar when you started, and please keep me apprised via email at questions@steveaustinshow.com. about your results / progress and your thoughts on this eating program. It is very strict. It is very hardcore. And if anybody decides to jump on it, do your research first, of course. Let me know how it goes for you. Pleasure talking to Dr. Sean Baker. And coming up on this Thursday's podcast, I got a real damn good podcast coming on Thursday. Professional wrestler Gregory Irons came by 317 Gimmick Street. Gregory Irons is the only professional wrestler in the world with cerebral palsy. And as a young man, he's from Cleveland, Ohio, had a tough upbringing, had a tough life coming up, And man, he was a pro wrestling fan and he wanted in the business. And he went and got trained and he got in the business and he's been kicking ass ever since. Give or take, he's about a 12-year vet. He's made a very successful tag team with Zach Gowan. And Zach Gowan is wrestles with one leg, and these guys are a damn good tag team, man. The teamwork that they put out there, the psychology that they use, the stuff that they're able to do is absolutely mind-blowing and it's super inspirational. So I had a great time talking to Gregory. He stayed over here for about 4 or 5 hours. We get a whole podcast in, and we recorded a bonus podcast that I'll play later. But it was just a great conversation with a young man that's just full of drive, determination, and just a go get 'em attitude and don't take any prisoners. It was a real eye-opener for me. I enjoyed talking to this cat as much as I've talked to anybody, and I wish him all the best in the world. If he ever comes back through L.A., I'd like to talk to him and Zach Gowan together. Just a great story. He's making rounds. He also does some motivational speaking, and he's got a lot to motivate you with. This guy has a never-say-die attitude, never-quit attitude, and you got to respect that in a person. So I enjoyed this conversation with Gregory Irons about as much as I've enjoyed a conversation with anybody I've done in this podcast in the last couple of years, and that's the bottom line. Check out my conversation with Gregory Irons. It's coming up this Thursday. Hey, man, ProWrestlingTees.com/Steve Austin has all the shirts from the Broken Skull Ranch. We're about to come out with some Nevada Edition stuff. And the best damn IPA on the planet is Broken Skull IPA, and that's the bottom line. You can find it here in Southern California at Whole Foods and Total Wines. And if you don't live in Cali, I guess you're shit out of luck. If you're looking to get a badass pocket knife, like the one I got in my right pocket, check out the Cold Steel Broken Skull Knife or my new Working Man Knife, and you can get them at my new Amazon store. Amazon has the best price on both knives. Just go to amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin or go directly to the website of Cold Steel Knives. They make the baddest knives in the business, the sharpest knives in the business, and that's the bottom line. I want to say one more thank you to all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show, especially DDP Yoga, Buffalo Wild Wings, True Car, Geico, TheraWorks. That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. Please support them because they support us. You can find all my sponsors at podcast1.com under the Killer Deals button at the top of the page. Folks, I am on social media, Twitter and Instagram, at Steve Austin BSR. To those of you who are out there riding the trails of the BLM in Nevada, if you see a green Kawasaki Terex in your rearview mirror, get your ass out of the way because I'm coming through. Folks, until next time, have a great 4th of July. My name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.